Hello, Joel here. I've got a new book out. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And it's about how comedy works and why it matters. Why human beings tell jokes, and then what that tells us about being human beings. So if you're a human being and you enjoy laughing and then want to know what the hell's going on with that, it's probably a pretty good book to read. It's called Be Funny or Die. It's in shops. You can buy it.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A podcast about comedy. I'm Jason Hazley.
And I'm Joel Morris.
As usual, we're joined by someone who makes comedy to talk about something funny that they love. By taking it apart, maybe we'll learn something about how comedy works, or we'll just quote bits from it and giggle until we think we're finished. Both approaches are valid. Our special guest today is Rufus Jones. Rufus is an award-winning writer and actor. He's probably best known in this room for his work on W1A and Hunderby, and he is in the forthcoming Stan and Ollie. Also, must be said, I've got to talk about your pilot, Home, your comedy blap, which I think is the best pilot I've ever seen.
It's very good.
It's so good.
You're unreasonably nice, Jason, but I won't stop you. Hello, everyone, by the way. Hello, boys.
Hello. Hi, Ruth.
Hey. It's Monday morning, and I wouldn't want to be anywhere else.
What have you brought to show us today?
I have bought, teachers, sirs, Midnight Run, which
Excellent.
Is a film from, I think, 1988. And it's Robert
Dark
De Niro.
Dark days, 1988, between the times.
That's right. The Berlin Wall was, you know, nearly falling.
Teetering.
Yeah, Mandela was putting on his going home shoes. And somewhere in Hollywood, an independent film was dressing itself up as a big movie studio blockbuster. That's my theory, anyway. And it's a film with Robert De Niro and Charles Grodin, directed by Martin Brest, who did Beverly Hills Cop, is probably best known for that. And it's one of those films that I thought I only knew for about 15 years. And then slowly collaborators creep out of the wallpaper.
Yeah.
And you realise that when I got into comedy, you realise everyone sort of knows it and is either passionate about it or just thinks, yeah, that's so much better than I thought it was going to be.
It's definitely got, you would expect from someone saying, it's a 1988 Robert De Niro action film, sort of, that you know what you're going to get. Weirdly, when you said, we sort of said to you, bring something on, and you emailed and said, I want to do Midnight Run. When the email arrived, I was halfway through watching Midnight Run. Because I had missed it and assumed it wasn't for me. And when people described it, I thought, it'll be one of those. I know what it'll be.
Yeah.
And when your email arrived, I was halfway through and I'd already decided it was brilliant. So it was a really nice thing to be invited to talk about because I've come new to it. And I think you as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was new to it as well.
Well, it's one of those films which, from the VHS front cover, doesn't look like it's going to be a barrel of laughs. And it's an 18. And it's Robert De Niro sort of manhandling Grodin, and you sort of think, oh, it's another sort of uncompromising tough guy thriller, and it's not.
I've read a couple of pieces that said this is the film that made Robert De Niro into a movie star.
That's right.
As in, he was an actor before. He's obviously incredible run of films set in the same kind of hard-boiled gangster New York, LA, Vegas kind of world that this is set in. But before then, he was an actor and wouldn't necessarily be big box office. And this is the film that begins the slow journey towards meet the parents or whatever it is.
And it is a slow journey.
But this is the peak of the slide. He's at the top of the astroglide getting his mat
he
out
is.
Here.
And the 80s were kind of weird for De Niro as well, because he kind of hit his apex, well, for many people, I guess, with King of Comedy, which is 82. Yeah. And you've got another 18 months after Midnight Run for Goodfellas. Yeah. And in between those two films, you've got some weird stuff. You've got The Mission, I think, Jackknife.
Well, he's trying different things. I read somewhere that he was trying to get big.
That's right.
He really wanted big. It's in the script for Big, and he wanted to be in Big. And you're thinking, this is a point where he could or wanted to get Tom Hanks's career.
So, something else I read that was great was that originally it wasn't going to be Charles Grodin. It was going to be Robin Williams. And then it was going to be Cher.
Oh, yeah. God, yes, I know, I read this version. It ended up at Universal, didn't it? But when it was at Paramount, Paramount were going, yeah, can we get Cher in and make it more of a kind of romance thing?
Right.
The number of times you read stories about studios wiping their asses on these screenplays that they've got. It's incredible.
What's great about this movie, and I think we should talk about this, because obviously we're talking about comedy here. This is an action movie, but it is an action comedy. And action comedy is a very interesting genre. The opening scene, the cold open at the beginning, which is like the beginning of a sitcom. It opens with a gag that De Niro is picking a lock. He fumbles the pick. He ducks down to pick the pick up, and the door blows out with a shotgun.
Yeah.
And it's got the pacing of a Buster Keaton gag. It's so well done. In that moment, you go, it's going to be thrilling and funny, and he's going to be a clown, and I'm going to enjoy the clowns in the thriller. So it sets those rules out. And yet, at the same time, this is an action comedy is a funny thing to do. You're wondering what's the core joke in this that works?
Yeah.
And halfway through watching it, I realised the core joke in this is Jim Field Smith's joke in The Wrong Mans.
Yeah.
These are the wrong people to be in this action movie.
Yeah, exactly.
And the reason they are, and I was going, something's up. What is it about their relationship? And I suddenly realised halfway through, because what they are is a married couple.
Yeah.
They're a married couple on a long road trip.
Yeah.
And then I read an interview with George Gallo, who wrote it, and he said he based the characters on his mum and dad.
Yeah.
At which point you go, this makes perfect sense. It is a bickering married couple on a long road trip where the car keeps breaking
down. It's so true, because so many odd couple films are portrayed as marriages.
Mm.
But they're normally just two men who disagree, you know, a civil partnership maybe, but not a husband-wife marriage. This comes as close to a husband-wife marriage with two men, because you have De Niro's character who has two expressions, silence and rage.
And then Grodin says, he says, you can't express yourself. He's the breadwinner.
Yeah.
He's the guy. And there's a brilliant scene where De Niro's credit card gets cancelled. De Niro turns up just trying to buy a bus ticket and gets turned down. The car gets declined. And the look on Grodin's face is the look of a wife who said, I promised. You said you'd pay the overdraft off.
Yeah.
Two one-way tickets to Los Angeles, please.
I'm sorry, sir, this card's been cancelled.
Huh? It's been cancelled? I'm sorry, that's a mistake. Would you please try it again?
I checked it twice, sir.
Please try it again. Please try it again.
Should pay the bill.
Shut up.
That's it. That's it. And what's great too, especially for an 80s movie, and what sort of reinforces that kind of marriage, is there are no wisecracks. There's no, what marks this out from Lethal Weapon, for instance, which is arguably, you know, I love Lethal Weapon. It's a good kind of frothy partnership there. But they're wisecracking all the time. They're saying things so funny so quickly, it just takes it out of something and you hear the writing.
Yeah.
Whereas De Niro and Grodin, there are funny lines, but it's more in delivery and it's more through the character fullness of it.
Yeah.
And so their kind of vulnerability just feels so much more authentic than so many of the other kind of Shane Black kind of cocaine scripts that were sort of circulating around Hollywood.
It's not a busy script. It's good lines and it's well written.
But it's characterful stuff.
It's all in the looks. If I look away from the screen, I'm missing half the jokes.
Yeah.
What I found really impressive, and it's one of the tricks I think that works with wisecracking scripts as well, is one of the funniest things and the most heroic things you can do in an action movie is underreact.
Yeah.
It's Arnie striding out of the exploding petrol station, or it's Daniel Craig shooting his cuffs as he walks through an exploding train. And underreacting is both cool as hell, because you're going, hey, this guy underreacts.
Look at him shooting his cuffs while
but
the explosion
also,
goes off.
Hilarious. You laugh. De Niro is underreacting to a certain degree. Yeah. And then you pair him with someone who underreacts even lower.
And it's also an adventure comedy where one guy can't do comedy and the other guy can't do adventure. So it's just perfect because, you know, they're just making it up as they go along.
Yeah, there's a feeling of it being very loose without it being indulgent.
Yeah, yeah. I heard a story which you're never quite sure whether anyone can back it up, that De Niro was... He was very anxious about this being a studio movie, for want of a better phrase. And he said, I only want actors who won't be intimidated by me, which is probably the most intimidating thing an actor could possibly say to a bunch of other actors who are about to work with Robert De Niro. But what it does mean is you get some brilliant character actors in some minor roles, all roles which in any other film would be relatively inconsequential. I mean, someone like Philip Baker Hall is in it.
Yeah, from Magnolia.
Right. He's an incredible character. He's got about 10 lines in it. Yaphet Kotto, who's, you know, kind of everyone's favourite Bond villain in a safari suit. And he turns Alonzo Mosley into this kind of mythical figure of,
good name.
Of frustration. Amazing. And the film is full of great names.
It does follow the Jack rule. All action heroes must be called Jack. It's Jack apparently Walsh. The easiest thing to shout.
Full name John Wesley Walsh, though, someone says it sounds like, which I quite like. You think, okay, he's so a John,
two,
he's not a Jack.
There's two Johns, then.
Yeah. Wow. Oh, hang on, who's the
Jonathan,
other?
Jonathan Mardukas.
Jonathan Mardukas.
Jonathan Mardukas, the Duke. Yeah, Duke. Neither of them are called John. The Duke and Jack.
Jack and the Duke.
Great.
Jack, and the, Jack and the Duke. Oh, Jack God. And the Duke.
That, I mean, that's Hunter S. Thompson. This is a gonzo movie. One of the things that makes it really funny, I think, is that not only are they a married couple, but also this is full of grown-ups acting like children.
Yeah.
If you want to understand how to write comedy, start with grown-ups behaving like children. And what this is Are We There Yet? But also with a gonzo take on two people who are basically little kids being selfish and whiny and petulant and things. With the guys who are on their tail, big
they're
names.
Being infantilized by the chaos.
Yeah, the chaos around them makes them... That great scene with the two gangsters who are on their tail and you go, wait, we've got proper wise guy gangsters. Yeah. And one of them's on the payphone and the other one is play fighting and doing karate That's kicks. Right.
When was Home six? Alone? Because Pesci and... Daniel Stern in that remind me so much of those bodyguards.
Is Home Alone after this?
Those hoods.
Home Alone's 86, is it?
So predates it possibly, but probably in production at the same time. And you got two, you just got two guys who are play fighting when they're not fighting the other guy.
The film that this immediately drew comparisons with in my head was Planes, Trains and Automobiles, which came out 7 months before this one. And that's the cartoon version of this, isn't it? Basically, it's the big silly... Yeah. Two guys who don't like each other who eventually do like each other on a road trip. It's the same structure.
I had a
very
tedious theory. I did a very tedious theory I'll regale you with. That Hollywood...
Go on, this is a place for tedious theories.
Narrow casting at its best. But Hollywood is based on chase movies. Yeah. From Max Sennett through... Chaplin having the village chase him around a mansion through the general, and it's all about the chase. It's moving to get somewhere. Mm. But then in the 60s, something happens, and the chase movie becomes the road movie, where it's not about the destination, it's about the journey.
Yeah.
And we all get existential, and we talk about each other, and that produces some great films. But what happens is the chase movie gets sort of forgotten, and it becomes more the province of action films, straight action.
Yeah.
And what Midnight Run does is take this surprisingly kind of moribund thing and re-inject the comedy. Because chases were originally funny things.
Keystone Cops.
Yeah, exactly.
The only movie this reminded me of was Spielberg's first movie, Sugarland Express.
Right, which I haven't
Goldie
seen.
Goldie Hawn movie. No one's seen it. And please do. It is so joyous. Do you like Spielberg movies? Would you like to see the movie he made immediately before Jaws? Because he was quite good at making films. And what that is a chase movie. It's a road movie and a chase movie. And it has... In it, and it's 1974, the same scene that's done again in Midnight Run, which is too many police cars.
Yeah.
And apparently it's a rule. Yeah. If an officer is in trouble, every officer in the area has to respond. Apparently it's a thing that they found out for Sugarland Express. So basically, once one car comes after them, every car has to come after them. And Sugarland Express has that scene that you see again in Midnight Run of just endless flashing lights.
Yeah.
I didn't realise one of the rules of Hollywood is seeing too many flashing lights in a row is never not fun.
Yeah.
And that number of police cars coming after them.
And that 80s trope of the police car just falling into a ditch.
Oh, I'd not seen as well. That pure Dukes of Hazzard thing. But I'd not seen a helicopter shot, because Jaffa Cottage in a helicopter, and taking the helicopter across the scene of the car chase, the Smokey and the Bandit car chase, to see 30 or 40 police cars with their noses in ditches. How much I'd enjoy seeing that.
And you know what marks out Midnight Run is for that shot? In a worse movie, that's just a helicopter shot.
Yeah.
But in Midnight Run, a character is in the helicopter. Yes. So there's a reason
for
that shot.
It's a motivated shot. Yeah. But it's that lovely thing. Michael Caine said it about the Italian Job. So the reason the Italian Job is popular is it's kids on the carpet playing with toy cars.
Yeah.
And there's something lovely about it. If you're going to do a big car chase, as they do in Midnight Run, it's another thing that stops it being an indie movie and makes it a big Hollywood movie. They do that car chase and it is as much fun as being a kid and playing cars. Mm. It's so joyous.
And just going back to what you were saying about Robert De Niro wanting to be in Big, this is your Robert De Niro as a 15-year-old film.
Yeah.
Funnily enough, the thing he finally gets to do on a studio scale is our man's man, independent actor, being sort of brought back down to his teenage self.
Yeah, the childishness of it is gleeful, I think. And one of the things that maybe makes it work is that one of the reasons you can't cast Cher in it. And they wanted to put Cher in it. Let's keep pretending
Cher's
there's
only one reason.
You can't put Cher in this because if you put sex in this film, it becomes adult.
Yeah.
It's full of swearing and adult. It's an 18 certificate film. There's one scene with women in it.
Yeah,
where he goes back, and it's a really touching
scene. And it breaks
your
heart. Yeah.
With his estranged wife and his daughter. Oh. God, the daughter's good.
Yeah.
The fact that you see De Niro when he's got no money and his daughter offers him her babysitting money and he says no, and you go, you're a decent man, I will watch you for the rest of this adventure.
I well up just thinking about this. It's amazing. it's extraordinary, because in a De Niro drama, that scene just becomes another good scene. Mm. And then this film, the fact that they found time for that scene in the edit, that's a really good director making space for...
It's a film that, you know, because of its register, can actually adopt a lot of different things, can't it? Because it's got the chases, it's got the heartfelt moments, the dialogue's very good, even though it's not, you can't hear the typewriter.
No.
You get those great lines like, I'm going to bury that telephone in your face and things like that, you know.
Yeah.
But also it's a very satisfying film, I think. Yeah. It does so much for you as a viewer.
It's
like the final takedown, which is basically the car chase done but in the airport, which is where suddenly the FBI, it turns out that nearly everybody in the airport is working for the FBI.
No one's taking a flight.
It's incredible. It's so satisfying. True.
There's a lot of good overkill in this, where suddenly sort of if something happens, it happens big. One of the big advantages of being an 80s studio picture is that when they want an entire airport full of FBI agents or a shootout in the middle of New York with the FBI versus the Mafia, it's big.
That's, you know, that's 400, 500 extras in a real airport. You know, I did a film a couple of years ago, a Jackie Chan film, which was in Stansted Airport. We had about 150 extras. And that's huge by today's standards. Yeah. You know, and to do that scene in the 1980s, I guess, was relatively standard. But by today's standards, it's enormous.
I imagine the hard thing to do, I mean, you've been in action movies and you've done work with Jim Field Smith, who works in the field of action comedy a lot. Surely the hardest thing to do is to keep an eye on the fact this is meant to be fun and entertaining when you've got those great big casts. But to try and keep a lightness of touch when you've got 400 extras must be almost impossible.
Because ironically, one of the things that helps you in an action comedy is, as long as you've got a plot that is driving, and it's complicated, and you've got to serve the plot, and I want to talk about that, by the way, because the plot in this is something I conveniently ignored for 20 years and then tried to write down and realised I couldn't. And by having to serve the, you know, the police story, I think it allows you, you know, the little oases of comedy that when they happen, enjoy them. But they're not going to last more than three pages because, you know, you've got the disc story happening or what's happening to Marvin over there and where's he in...
Because the plot, there's an interesting thing that reminded me of Donald E. Westlake and The Hot Rock and those guys who write hard-boiled crime thrillers that are very funny. There's a thing in these thrillers that a little bit of dialogue about bail bonds or a little bit of dialogue about how you can get the guy if he sets foot in the airport because of the law in Vegas. And you go, your brain tunes out at those points. And goes, this is chutney.
I'm glad yours does.
This is just chutney. As long as I understand, he mustn't set foot in the airport. Yeah. And I imagine it's 2 days' research from someone.
Because there's a scene between Yaphet Kotto and Robert De Niro. Robert De Niro's saying, you know, and you can get him on intent to supply and da da da. And Yaphet Kotto goes, well, to be honest, Walsh, that's all bullshit unless you can get him to take the discs. And that's the audience speaking.
Yeah, that's the audience going,
yada, yada, yada. Okay, great, you've got him on 6 federal offences, but frankly, that's just to make us all feel professional.
Yes.
What we want is just arrest him for something that we assume is legal.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
In any action comedy, you're watching two parallel things. One is an action movie and one is a comedy movie. You want to trust that when the clutch goes down, the gears disengage and we get a funny scene, that someone's looking after the plot. And the way you do that, I think, is by using a lot of crime bullshit that the audience goes, oh, I bet they've thought about this.
Yeah.
This is covered.
I think there's a very particular experience of watching Midnight Run as a British person, because we don't do bail or bail bond.
Does anyone in this room know what that is?
Yeah, so, shall I tell you?
Have you looked it up?
Yeah, I
have. He's done his homework.
I'm going to form a self-help group, because I put it out on Twitter, and then John Niven immediately came back with, of course I understand the plot. How the fuck do you not understand? But so basically, when Jonathan Mardoukas, when Charles Grodin gets arrested, there is a period between your arrest and turning up in court, okay? And in order to serve that time outside prison, just as a free man, you got to post bail. But the bail is hugely expensive. So you get a bond. You get a bail bondsman, which is Eddie Mascon, half
a fee. It looks like a minicab office. He's working
exactly. Exactly. But then he skips bail. So Charles Grodin
runs away.
All he has to do is just stay at home, but he runs away.
Right.
And Eddie Mascon, in order to not default on the bond, has to get him back to LA within 5 days, or he's out to the tune of something like $450,000. That's it. But there's so much assumed in the opening bit where Pantaleano talks to De Niro in the breakfast scene, and he says, hey, you know, Jesus Christ, Jack, it's a midnight run. You got midnight what? What?
Oh, good.
But I like the phrase.
Guys, come on. It's a basic midnight run movie.
Exactly. It's your standard midnight run. Yeah. But my other slightly more interesting theory is the thing that leavens the bread for a British viewer, even though you don't know what the fuck's going on, is that he's a bounty hunter.
Yes.
And there's one bounty hunter that I grew up loving, and he flew the Millennium Falcon. And I never really understood what Han Solo did for a job.
He's a space pirate.
And he owed money to Jabba the Hutt.
And also, you know that he can be funny.
Yeah.
Because the smuggler and the pirate in Star Wars, he's got all the best lines.
Exactly.
So your brain goes, hey, he's going to be a bit flipped.
And also, Han Solo always wanted to open up a coffee shop. That's the thing. This is what it shares. And you follow it through to the nth degree, and this is Han Solo and C-3PO on the run.
What this created, and I wrote this down because I can't believe it didn't occur to me the first time I watched this. Second time around, I went, oh my God, the number of lines and scenes in this that turn up again in Tarantino.
Oh, I had exactly the same thought. So, okay, so here's my third tedious theory.
But this is where action comedy comes in. You go, flippant gangster.
So this is 6 years before Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
And the bit where Farina says to Grodin two things. One, you're going to die tonight. Two, I'm going to go home. I'm going to have a nice hot meal. I'm going to find your wife. I'm going to kill her too. And it's completely chilling. Nice hot meal, though.
Yeah.
Is that a royale with cheese, Dennis?
It's potatoes Lyonnaise.
Are you familiar with a dish of a potato dish, a Lyonnaise potato? It's a kind of a fried potato, but it's got like an onion in it. It's quite delicious. It really goes beautifully with steak, chops, you know, hamburger, cheeseburger, any of your meat dishes. It's just I have enough money to buy you as much Lyonnaise potatoes as you ever.
Just shut the fuck up, will you, please?
Right.
And it's also Grodin telling De Niro to tip the waiting staff, because these people depend on their tips. So I remember when I first saw Reservoir Dogs thinking, this is a new thing. This was a genre that had fallen possibly from fashion.
Yeah.
Because they were the wisecracking, lethal weapon-y, die-hardy, slightly more flip action movies.
Yeah.
This is a good, dry, 1970s funny action thriller.
I think you're right.
But you kind of went, well, it was still going on. It's just no one was looking.
Yeah.
How much more attention do you want to draw to it than put Robert De Niro in it?
Yeah. No, it's true. It's true. Even going back to, you know, Hackman in French Connection, who I sort of idolise, but that whole you pick your feet stuff. It's all micro characterization amidst high stakes poker.
Yes.
And what I love about that Farina, I'm going to have a nice hot meal, is that it's that very particular mafia thing where revenge is not a dish served cold. It's served really warm with a side of fries.
I'm having a nice life.
Yeah. You are merely the amuse-bouche.
Yeah.
My life goes on.
I'm very relaxed about killing.
Yeah, this is really not...
What do we think? Yeah. What do we think? I'm not an actor. You are. What's De Niro doing in this? Because it's a lovely performance, isn't
it? Yeah, it is. I tell you what, it's been possibly his most handsome.
Point.
He's about sort of 38, I think, and maybe younger, I don't know, but he just looks great. And I think also there's a lot of all the De Niroisms that we would incorporate into our, you know, 5-pint Robert De Niro impression are all present in this film in ways that actually they aren't necessarily in other films. So, you know, the way that he sort of talks to the third person who's not in the scene, like this guy.
Yeah.
Who are you talking to? Talking to the audience, of course, you're a clever man. But it's all there, the smile that looks like he's, you know, chewing a wasp, and it's all employed in a really convenient sort of 2-hour movie. But what you have is De Niro in the middle of a comedy treating it with utmost seriousness, but shy of the pantomime that he sort of ended up doing in Meet the Parents.
And against that, and this is something I'm desperate to talk to you about, is something you've got the guy treating the comedy with seriousness, which is De Niro.
Yeah.
Against him, you have Grodin, who is treating the seriousness as if he's in a sitcom.
Yeah.
And the thing that I noticed in this, and I looked this up just to double check, it's a bit Lemon and Matow. It's a bit Odd Couple. So I thought, hang on, where are we talking about religion-wise here? So I looked it up, and you've got a guy with Orthodox Jewish parents. And Grodin is the classic thing that I know that you're fascinated by, the Jewish guy in an action movie.
Yeah.
Which is the thing that is unsaid about Harrison Ford.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Give Walter Matthau a bullwhip and see what happens.
Oh, you get, as we've talked about before, you get Indiana Jones. The only reason that performance works, and there's a lot of Harrison Ford in both of them in this, it's two indies, it's great.
Yeah.
Even down to the fact that De Niro's costume ends up as battered, it's the leather jacket and battered.
It's half Han Solo, half Indiana Jones.
It's that thing, you've got those guys, and you go, why are those guys funny? Why are they fun? Why do I enjoy watching them? And the idea is you've got someone who goes, Nazis, I hate those guys.
Yeah.
In the middle of quite a serious action film.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that can't be underestimated is how good Charles Grodin makes De Niro look. But the space he gives De Niro, it's sort of magnificent. And he just, you hear in all these scenes Grodin just muttering in the background, just kind of noodling in between De Niro's kind of repetition acting. And it just, it offsets so well. Yeah. And Grodin's pace is, it's almost like a love story pace. It's so slow.
Yeah.
Like Grodin just, he's got explosions, he's got helicopters running at him, but he will take his time to say the line. And again, it's like, it's a small indie movie pace, which is, it's like a very slow moving train through this this crazy action film. There's something so attractive about watching that. And watching De Niro, who I think sort of, certainly by that stage, you look at him as the, like Corleone in Godfather 2, or even the Deer Hunter. He was a man of authority, wasn't he? He was like tremendous. And even Travis Bickle. Yeah. You know, here's a guy who very slowly gets on with his plan. And there's a method to the madness, you know, with De Niro's characters. But here, he's low stakes. He's low status. He's, you know,
a schlub.
He's a schlub. And he's always running. He's got a bad run. He's really stiff. A bit like Harrison Ford, you know, not great runners. They're no Mel Gibson.
Yeah.
And it's very attractive to see Robert De Niro sort of harried. I think. Rushed.
There's a phrase I wrote. This whole film is a graceless shambles. It's a stumble. Yeah. Them trying to get on the train, the groceries.
The shopping goes
it's
everywhere.
It's been such an effort to get those groceries. Yeah. The physicality of this, which is, as you said, it's Keystone Cops, it's slapstick, which is something I remember, again, with action comedy, Jim Fieldsmith saying that he made Matt Bainton and James Corden in The Wrong Man's run like they'd seen action heroes run, but they can't quite do it.
Exactly.
De Niro has a funny punch. The number of times that a punch is used as literally a punchline, punctuate scenes with physicality, a punch knocks someone out.
Marvin, Marvin, Marvin!
Bum, bum. Then Marvin himself uses the car door as his weapon of choice. He's constantly knocking people over with a car door. And you go, this is Laurel and Hardy with a plank.
Yeah, it's slapstick. There's a similar bit that outlines that where they're stealing a car right towards the end. They're in Arizona and De Niro's literally climbing into the hood to kind of jumpstart it. And you just hear Grodin off camera going, oh, great, another crime.
You guys are the dumbest bounty hunters I've ever seen! You couldn't even deliver a bottle of milk!
And it's just tossed away, but it's so glorious because, and it goes back to our thing that there are no punchlines here. Mm. The most elegant line for me is right at the end, very moving scene where he gives him the money, not a payoff, a gift. And he says it's in the neighbourhood of $300,000, and De Niro says it's a very respectable neighbourhood, which is so... it's such a well-crafted line.
And the double meaning of he wants to open a coffee shop, and your brain goes, well, the coffee shop will be in a more respectable neighbourhood.
Exactly.
It's just weighted. Both meanings work thoroughly.
Yeah.
That payoff and that level of writing, the other thing this reminded me of, which I don't think you'd think of as a connection, is Breaking Bad.
Oh, yeah, no.
These are guys who come from sitcom who've got the pacing and the musicality that you need to deliver a sitcom.
Yeah.
And yet they're being given a serious gangster film.
It's almost more than that, in the sense that what TV did after The Sopranos in creating you these total bits of art, where it's your favourite comedy, it's your favourite drama, it's your favourite action thing, it's your favourite love story. It's everything you need from TV for, you know, 6 weeks while you sort of digest the whole thing. Midnight Run sort of, it feels like it helps to create that, because as a film, it's one of those things that I can just pick up at any stage when it's on TV, and I'll watch it to the end. I might loop round, you know, and you'll just happily watch it like you would do in the cinema in the 60s, and just kind of
an endless chase,
an endless loop, and it's feel good mac and cheese movies, and totally satisfying. So one of the reasons it's so difficult to categorize is because for me it's pressing all the buttons that I need pressed from normally three different movies. But Midnight Run does it all for me.
And there's a brilliant example of it, which took me years to notice, which is the Return of the Pink Panther, the Christopher Plummer jewel heist Pink Panther movie, where there are two movies going on at once. One is a jewel heist movie that's about as good a jewel heist movie as you'll ever see, with a monofilament wire and the person in black with a crossbow and proper violence.
Yeah.
And then between those scenes, there's some pratfalls with Sellers at the peak of his game. They're never blended. The real achievement is to have a movie which at no point are you turning any of those buttons off. And I think this is a great example of a film where the action is funny.
Yeah.
And the funny stuff is thrilling.
Yeah.
And it doesn't feel, you can't hear the gears clunking.
No, that's true. But I think too, though, whenever you write a half-hour comedy or a pilot for TV or film, there's always after the first draft the notes. And the notes are so often, they're never about the jokes. No. They're always about the plot.
Yeah. Yeah.
And no matter how experienced you are, there's always that, just let me be funny.
Yes.
Oh, fuck off and just let me be funny. It'll work, they'll buy it, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is a great example, and it's the one I always try and keep in the front of my head, that whenever I feel like that on draft three, remember the films you love, because often the plot is this absolute Rolls Royce, and yet I spent 20 years ignoring the plot, but what it did was carry the jokes in the most beautifully magnificent way.
And, it's the vehicle. It's the vehicle.
It's literally the vehicle. And, you know, road movies are great, but if it's just about the journey, you know, you've got to be really good to be just about the journey.
Yeah.
The great thing about a chase film is it allows you these pools of comedy which just hum when they're done well.
Yeah.
And makes you think that you watched a comedy, even though you've kind of watched a thriller, and it's
a trick. I think that's we use the phrase when you're adding jokes. Jokes are extraneous; they're not needed in the nicest possible way. The first thing that gets sacrificed in an edit very often is the jokes, because they're protuberances, they're peacock tails, they're horns and frills on the thing. And we always say that the first thing that happens when you run a thing you've written is you run it down the road and bits of it fall off.
Yeah.
And they're always the fins and the aerials and the things. But I like the car having fins and aerials. And you go, it doesn't need it. It needs wheels and a chassis.
What's under the hood?
And it's a really hard thing to let those things go. And you keep trying to bolt them back on. Then you drive it and it falls off again. And the jalopy's falling apart. It's like a clown car.
Yeah.
But you do need a vehicle that works. And I think this is a good example of something which, you're right, you should look at this and say, actually, it's not constantly dancing and jiggling about trying to make me laugh. But I am laughing and enjoying myself. It's so entertaining.
Yeah.
That it's a very good argument saying, just keep the plot working.
It's also, it's a real film to watch for running jokes as well.
The sunglasses
and the cigarette. Most of them are Yaphet Kotto's, weirdly.
He's carrying the yucks. Guy.
The whole stealing the cigarettes, John Ashton's line of why don't you give up, it'd be cheaper for both of us, which is the other great line in it. But it's so beautiful because on its own, these aren't jokes. This is just a characterful quirk. But done five times through the movie, and when the movie finds time to remind you that, he's the glasses guy.
Yeah.
You know, Marvin always looks behind when there isn't anyone there.
Yeah.
It's I don't know, the dividends sort of increase the more, the further you get through the film.
What you're talking about there is comic pacing. That's a callback. That's like a stand-up routine.
Yeah.
What it's got is the music and the rhythm of a comedy, regardless of how many lines are in it.
Yeah.
Probably its biggest function, I think, is to answer that question, which people are asking a lot at the moment, about what is a comedy? How much where does comedy drama, where's the crossover point?
Yeah.
Can things that are intrinsically dramatic be awarded sitcom awards and things? We're in this sort of flux state at the moment.
Anything
with comedy.
Anything.
And what's interesting about this is there's no point at which you'd say this was a serious drama.
No. This whole theme about no happy endings through this, even though there's a beautiful one.
Yeah. Oh, they earn that.
But
God,
the scene with his daughter is so crucial, because him driving away without taking her pocket money is the right thing to do, but so desperately sad that you kind of go, Jesus, this film may not offer me the ending I need.
Yeah.
And then at the whole see you in the next life, Jack, there's a kind of sense that, you know, we're all going to die.
and
we're not going to keep in touch.
When Grodin disappears, he turns back and Grodin's vanished. It's almost as if he was a ghost or an angel. It's like Clarence.
Yeah.
He's come down to show him the other life he
could
have. Sort of metaphysical. He has been saved by the most annoying man on earth.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Who is the most annoying, but also is the friend you want to make almost immediately in the pub, because he's so avuncular, Grodin. He's just got this amazing sort of warmth to him. And the character's clever, because he's pressing De Niro's buttons, but he's also able to fly.
Yeah.
and just when you think they're sort of getting close, he tries to run away again.
Anyone who hasn't seen the film, he's not actually literally able to fly.
Oh, yeah, he's not able to fly.
He doesn't suddenly take off like Christopher Reeve. What a twist.
That's casting. That's casting. Wow.
Do you want me to fly? I can do it. Yeah, skills include horse riding, fencing, and also I can fly.
Man. But going back to De Niro, I think this is the film. It's the film I love him most for, because you see him sort of out of a certain comfort zone.
Yeah,
it's not method. He's not, he's not learning to cobble.
Is he a method actor usually?
Yeah, and quite genuinely so. Sort of Strasberg.
Well, weirdly, Grodin studied under Strasberg.
Really, I think it was kind of lazily applied to De Niro and everyone since. But I mean, he learned to fight for Raging Bull to the extent that LaMotta said he could have been a pro. It was ridiculous.
Wow.
He was just preposterously talented in that. But he learned to play the saxophone for New York, New York, that weird film with Liza Minnelli. And, you know, the guy applies himself.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow, I didn't know that.
He's just not, you know.
He learned to wear sunglasses for this one.
And yeah, exactly. Well, this is it with Midnight Run. You kind of go, well, okay, in virtually every other De Niro film, I could see the thing you trained to do for 3 months before filming. The one thing in Midnight Run I look at and go, you had a real look at this, was the lock picking. They do it twice. They do it at the beginning of the film, like 15 minutes in, and he does it really well. And I think it's a pan from his face down to his hands. It's Bob doing it, and he insisted, "Stay with me." And it's really good. And he wiggles, and it's messy. And arguably, that lot picks the kind of metaphor for the film, because it's messy. It doesn't quite work. It's like, no, we're gonna wait for 5 seconds while De Niro gets through the door.
What's fascinating about this is that it sits, I think, more than anything I've ever seen, in that midpoint between comedy and drama, and does it in a way that tells you secretly what both are trying to do, which is it is just entertaining.
Yeah.
And I think that if you work in comedy, you can get too serious about it, and if you work in drama, you can definitely get too serious about it. And this movie just sits in the middle and goes, why doesn't everyone just have fun?
Yeah, exactly. And I think I certainly, with my sort of acting cape on, it's
can you fly?
It's exactly, it's exactly the experience that when you receive a script that purports to be drama, you go, how can I make this bit funny?
Yeah.
And whenever you get the comedy script, you go, how can I, you know,
break their hearts?
Yeah, how can I break their hearts? And I the performer's instinct is always to, you know, kind of hop between the genres, possibly unhelpfully. But this is a film that sort of has the same sort of instinct, and you wonder how much was in the script, and you wonder how much is Martin Brest, the director. Yeah. I think loads of it is De Niro and Grodin going, you know, this bit that was written here as a wry little three-pager, let's actually bring the tone down and make it about two men discussing, you know, the divorce or the fact that they're going to die before they even get to jail. You know, and it's so well considered and very contrary as a film.
I think as a writer, I look at it and go, I don't know how I'd write this down.
No.
I don't know how I'd write this in a way that someone would buy it off me to make it. Yeah. Because so much is unsaid.
I bet there were loads more jokes in the script. As in, and by jokes, I mean, let's get the flock out of here, sort of Mel Gibson one-liners.
Yeah.
And I bet they were dropped. By De Niro.
I can do that with a look.
Yeah. Because and also the moment you get Grodin in place, that becomes a different script.
Yeah.
To Robin Williams, can you imagine?
Yeah.
With the best will in the world. You know, that was De Niro, Robin Williams worked in Awakenings, but one of them was in a deep state coma.
Yeah.
You have to put one of them in a dramatically convenient coma.
Exactly. It would have been intolerable.
Otherwise the audience will become over-adrenalised.
Exactly.
I suppose what you're talking about here is something which is made by collaboration.
I think so.
Which I think as well, God, the rows you have. As you said, when someone's fiddling with your script, someone's giving notes, and you're going, don't spoil the pristine genius of what was there. And the answer is, well, collaborate, take good advice.
Yeah. Yeah. Surround yourself with good people and be prepared when it gets to shooting day for Robert De Niro to throw your script away and just go, right, we're in a train carriage, let's do this.
So this is a good tip for aspiring writers. Just as long as you can secure Robert De Niro.
Is
that the charm?
Yeah, I think it might be the secret. If you can secure Robert De Niro 35 years ago.
Yeah, that's doable, isn't it?
Yeah.
They'll be able to do it with CGI now.
Yeah,
you might just buy off the peg a plug-in, which is Robert De Niro 1988.
Yeah, or any year. Yeah, any year, De Niro.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much, Rufus.
Thank you, boys.
For bringing in the delightful Midnight Run.
Wasn't that fun?
Cheers.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.